We continue now with our series of discussions on the campus crisis, the student demonstrations, the sit-ins, bust-ins, mill-ins, takeovers, sieges, and other disruptive tactics that have kept an increasing number of colleges and universities in turmoil. And in common with you, we would like to find out why all this is happening, when it might end, if it's going to. And to that purpose, on Monday, we heard from several students who are on our program, radical and moderate students. Yesterday, we heard the viewpoints of three college presidents. Today, we take up the viewpoint of the faculty, the professors who are caught in the middle between the students and the administration. And we have with us Professors Max Black and Richard Hufferbert, both of Cornell University. And in the recent Cornell conflict, Professor Black and Professor Hufferbert found themselves on different sides of the controversy. I want to welcome you both to today and then get these two sides. Maybe it would be best if you gentlemen explain the substance of the disagreement that you had. Professor Black, first.
Well, I'm not really sure whether there is all that disagreement between Rick and myself. We are for both of us teachers, and that means that on the most fundamental things we are in agreement. But there was certainly disagreement about tactics, at least that. And the crucial question was whether the faculty would stand firm on the legalities, which were undeniable, would simply support the action of its committee, and say that the only way that that could be changed was by proper judicial procedures. Some of us thought on the fateful Wednesday, 2 weeks ago, that the situation had become so desperate that other considerations, including the possibility of a massacre on the Cornell campus, overrode any immediate questions of legality. Probably Rick disagrees with this.
Yes, I believe I do. I did vote against the specific actions, one of the specific actions that the faculty took, which was to remove certain sanctions that had been applied by the campus judicial system to a number of black students for some minor infringements. However, this, as I think most of the events of recent weeks on our campus and many other campuses, was not a vote in the specifics of the instance. Rather, I think my position was that we had to view the instances there as the end of a waterfall, as a long road which had been traveled, where a series of compromises had been made, where a series of concessions had been made, usually in the threat of some, in the face of the threat of some sort of vaguely stated retaliation by black students and presumably by SDS. I was concerned, and I think this is one of the problems that has not been properly enunciated by many of the people involved. I was concerned very much about the consequences for academic freedom and the necessity for leadership within our campuses from administration, faculty, and students in defense of academic freedom in an atmosphere in which it's been seriously eroded. And I felt that under a threat of this type, it was inappropriate to compromise.
I think it's important at this point just to review, even though some of you, I'm sure, know it, what those steps were, what happened there after you saw the pictures in the news of black students having armed themselves with guns after a fiery cross had been burned, and there was a feeling on their part that whites in the community were similarly armed. Mm-hmm. The amnesty that was promised, perhaps it'd be better if you gentlemen outlined the steps and how the reversal came about on the part of the administration.
Well, the administration signed an agreement with the black students who had seized Willard Strait Hall, which is the Union Building, promising amnesty and so on. The only thing that affected the faculty was the question of a verbal reprimand for three black students involved in an episode back last December, and minor mischief like overturning candy machines. Mm-hmm. So that the ostensible issue was very trivial. I mean, it was the question of whether the faculty in the Cornell University would say to three black students, you were naughty boys to do this and your parents will be informed. It's very interesting that so much heat and fuss should be generated by something. But of course, the big issues behind this were that the black students refused to regard the student conduct machine as legitimate. What they say is that they are the spearheads of an oppressed people. They are at war, perhaps, certainly in conflict with Cornell. And for Cornell to take any kind of stand in a case to which it isn't a party is unjust. I mean, that's the black position, while the academic position is that this is an academic institution, it's not a political institution, and that any student of whatever color, here Rick I know will agree with me, has got to abide by the rules.
Absolutely.
So what the faculty was required to do was to say, as it had every right to, whether it wished to overturn the action of its committee and go along with what the black students wanted.
Now, why the reversal is what I want to get at.
The reversal, by Wednesday, in my judgment, Cornell was right on the brink of a most terrible disaster. I think if a single shot had been fired on the campus and there were plenty of police around, we would have had something like a massacre with black and white students killed. I think, furthermore, that the ghettos would have responded as they did to the assassination of Martin Luther King. And I, for one, was not prepared to have that kind of event in my conscience. So, rightly or wrongly, I felt then that all immediate questions of legality, of principle, were simply to be overridden in the face of a terrible emergency. And I voted, so far as possible, to get this point out of the way, with the understanding that all of us, students, faculty, administration, would try and look to the future rather than to the past and try to do better. I think any university which has to settle a question of this sort in such a way that there is grave risk of warfare on the campus has got itself into a terrible position, and that everybody involved has got to take some responsibility. I certainly accept some.
Well, I would agree that the university had placed itself in a terrible position, and this was what I was addressing my vote to. I think the potential for massacre, as you've called it, may be somewhat over-dramatized. And the thing that concerns me here, and has concerned me for the last couple of weeks, is that we not view each university which has had a crisis of this type, and particularly in Cornell, that we not view the purposes and future of the university from the perspective of a single weekend. The point I tried to make before was that I felt that this was not the result of events of a particular weekend. Admittedly, we couldn't ignore those, and I'm perfectly prepared to admit that rational and compassionate men could have, and many did vote as Professor Black did. I also feel, however, that it was an appropriate time to enunciate the definition of the university. The problem we've had at Cornell is not unlike the problem at many other universities. The university has sought to be all things to all people. We have, in the vernacular of our students, we've become a service station institution. We're there to serve the corporate interests of the society. We're there to serve the government. We're there to serve the causes of social reform. All of these are laudable goals, and I'm sure in the larger society, Professor Black and I don't disagree.
In the light of the student, they aren't all laudable goals. Many students feel that they should be for learning and teaching and students rather than for the defense of any established order.
Perhaps not an established order. I think the students, many of the students would argue that it's not for teaching and learning, but it's in defense of an order yet to be established. You see, we are dealing, and I've come to this conclusion very reluctantly, we are dealing with a revolutionary cadre. Now, I can't say you can spot 12 people on the Cornell campus whose removal would somehow remove the wounds from our midst, but we are dealing with a revolutionary cadre whose principles of action simply are not met by minor compromise, are not met by anything within the power of the university to deliver. The university is specialized in the context of the larger society, and we have to recognize the nature of our specialization.
Now, we'll be back in just a moment with our guests at 12 minutes before the hour. Now, here's Barbara to tell you how to make a delicious drink called a strawberry steamer. Barbara.
Thank you, Hugh. Have you been wondering what sort of snack to fix for the pajama party brigade? Well, when hungry, thirsty kids get together at your house, may I suggest that you serve delicious, nutritious, hot milk drinks, like quick and easy strawberry steamers. You just follow these simple directions. You mix 1/4 cup strawberry syrup or jam with 2 cups milk and 1/4 teaspoon almond extract and a dash or two of red food coloring. And you serve these hearty mugs of milk with snack crackers and cheese tidbits. What a terrific treat for the youngsters. They'll think you're really a swinging mom. But the nicest part about hot and cold milk drinks is that they're so rich in the nutrients your family needs. So look this simple recipe over once again and enjoy a big mug of strawberry steamer, so tasty for afternoon and evening snacks, and a great way to wake up the kids in the morning. You know, there are so many ways to enjoy the goodness of milk, hot or cold. It helps give adults and children the energy and the vitality they need every day. the American Dairy Association reminds you to refresh with milk for a big lift that lasts. And we're going to be back with Hugh and his guests after the station break.
British comedians Peter Cook and Dudley Moore welcome folk singer Donovan tonight.
We're back now with our guests, Professors Max Black and Richard Hofferbert, both of Cornell University. And we're continuing our series about the student unrest on college campuses. Traditionally, gentlemen, the faculty in a university situation was the central force that professors were supposed to make the decisions that determined where the university was going. And lately, the charge is made that the power has shifted to an administration. And some educators say that unless the faculty takes firm hold of power or in some way bolsters the administration, that there's not likely to be peace on the campus. What is your view
on that? Well, one of the problems here is the idea of power in a campus is somewhat anachronistic anyway, because a university is a massive, loosely constructed holding company. I've never been able to identify loci of power on a campus anyway. There has indeed been a shifting. There's a shifting that follows the size of the organization. I think it's very difficult to ask a faculty of, in the case of Cornell, some 1,200 men, to somehow lead themselves, to lead themselves out of crisis. They have to have leadership. They have to have leadership supplied from someone, whether from within their own midst or hopefully from the university, and on many occasions, and rightly so, from the students.
Professor Black, if the faculty were to run universities rather than the administration, would there be less attention? Would there be less trouble, do you think?
I don't think so. I think the problems are too difficult to be solved by a mere shift in responsibility from a president and his advisors over to the faculty. I don't think the faculty would do any better than the administrations are doing, partly because I don't altogether agree with Rick's emphasis upon the revolutionaries. Of course, they're there, and they're a small body, mm-hmm. but they wouldn't be doing the damage they're doing unless the great mass of the students of America and of the world were seriously disaffected. This was our problem. If it was a matter of dealing with 50 or 60 black students or 100 or 150 SDS, it would be relatively simple. We were faced with a situation in which thousands of Cornell students felt that justice was on the side of the protesters. And this is a very wide feeling, that is to say, quite moderate students who would not dream of seizing a building still believe that the society is unjust and that universities, to the extent they reflect the unjust sides of the society, are themselves not universities that are worth defending. Consequently, I don't think that this stress on academic freedom, important, essential though it is, goes to the heart of the matter. There is a crisis of confidence. Academic freedom is no use to me if the students don't really trust me and want to defend my rights as well as their own. If they don't, then any assertions that I have the right to teach and so on will be empty because they won't be listening.
But this is where we have been derelict, I think, in if you speak of faculty responsibility. It seems abundantly clear to me after the past 2 weeks talking about academic freedom to some of our students that they don't understand what it is.
Well,
and in this context,
we may have
failed with each other, too. Mm-hmm. To the extent that there is an obligation here, it seems to me it's a definition of the moral community of a faculty who recognize threats upon one another. We call it academic freedom. It's sort of full-time freedom of speech. I mean, we do it as an occupation. It's really not that much different from the rights that the Constitution guarantees to everyone. But here's where we failed, it seems, in communicating this specialized nature of the university to the students. You speak of the society's problems and the sensitivities of the students to them. I hope they are. I'm somewhat optimistic about the solution of these problems when this generation of students go out and begin to run their own communities. I know that may seem anachronistic given the stance I've taken in the last few weeks. But this does not mean that the university itself is the principal agent for the solution of these problems, and it's up to us to tell the students that it's
I absolutely agree, and it's part of a larger failure to communicate with the students. I don't mean just uttering words, but to let the large body of students know that they and the large body of teachers have a common interest as against the wild people. Now, so long as this great middle force is left there without leadership and without understanding, without conviction, then, of course, the medicine men and the wild men have a field day. I think that's the immediate problem.
But it can be transformed, it can be translated into a responsibility for those who occupy the central positions of the university and themselves define the nature of the university for the public.
Does this failure relate in any way to the publish-or-perish problem where professors have withdrawn from teaching except in token?
Well, I don't like these old cliches. That one I hate particularly, if you don't mind my saying so. But the fact is that a scholar is committed to learning, and learning is not conducted in the classroom as far as the scholar goes, though it is for the student, and it is not conducted in a place where you have constant meetings, disruptions, and strikes. So if you are interested in science and in academic scholarship, you need a quiet campus. And the best scholars are the worst politicians. Now, we are in a political situation where the teachers, just to maintain and defend the university, have got to become politicians, have got to meet their students as political animals, even if they don't like it. You see, Rick, I can see he's shaking his head.
I do not agree with it. I do not agree with it. I think it's asking too much, and I think it's asking for a significant dilution of our ability to remain objective critics. Well, I don't think we can be politicians and objective critics at the same time.
I think
that's
are a
the root dilemma.
Already,
this more or less naturally leads to a mention of tomorrow's segment, because we've heard different viewpoints of the faculty, two members of the Cornell University faculty, on the crisis on the campus. And tomorrow our discussion is going to continue in Washington with Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, who's sponsoring a bill to discipline and punish students who cause disturbances on campus, and Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon, who opposes such legislation. The time right now, thank you, gentlemen, for being with us. The time right now is 4 minutes before the hour, and we have a word from Georgia Pacific, the company that makes all kinds of products for your home. Watch.
Gentlemen, I can live with the fact that our competitor, Cornet paper towels, are soft, strong, absorbent, and beautiful. What bothers me is that Cornet has more towels than our two-ply roll. That means more of everything. Gentlemen, doesn't our product have just a little something more than Cornet?
We charge more, J.R.
Cornet towels by Georgia Pacific.
The drama of the old world is deep within these walls. Yet this aged look is brand new. This is Georgia Pacific's old world paneling, charming, elegant, and as little as $25 for an 8x12 foot wall. See old world paneling at your Georgia Pacific dealer.
Some great points made in each of these series, I think, by the guests we've had, the students Monday, the university professors yesterday, and our faculty members today. And just to reiterate, tomorrow on today, we'll be talking with Senators Robert Byrd, a Democrat of West Virginia, and Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon about the legislation that is proposed by Senator Byrd to punitive legislation against students who cause disruption on the campus, and the reasons that Senator Hatfield disagrees with that. Well, have a good day if you're leaving us now, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Elizabeth.
Station break.